Hello and welcome to another podcast from the Naval Historical Society of Australia. This is one of the many talks in the archives of the Society recorded over nearly two decades from 1973 until 1980, and now available for you through the Society's website. Today we're listening to Mr. Ron Cooper, member of the Aviation Historical Society. He talks about airships, zeppelins, their design and their construction.
I think tonight it'll be a fairly general lecture on the early airships. Possibly draw a few comparisons and give one or two little known facts. One of which is that zeppelins also saw a very limited service in World War II. The extent of one flight along the English coast. Zeppelins had their beginning possibly with the original hot air balloon flown by the Montgolfiers, in which a couple of paper manufacturers in France apparently, as legend has it, watched particles rising from their fire and built a small balloon of paper and filled with hot air, and this thing rose. Eventually they sent one aloft with some animals, and later they sent a couple of intrepid men aloft in one. Oddly enough, whilst their balloon was successful, the reason why it was successful was completely unknown to them. They thought that hot air contained some mystical substance which caused it to rise, whereas today we know that it's merely because the heat expands the air and thus makes it less dense than the surrounding air. Well, shortly after the Montgolfiers used the hot air, they found it had several limitations. First of all, the air gets cooled very quickly, so it meant they had to take the fire aloft with them. And fire and paper balloons are not a particularly good combination. So it wasn't long before the balloons were made of silk, oil silk and other various treated silk, and filled with hydrogen. Now this was quite good. This meant the balloons would stay aloft much longer, but it still fell short of the one requirement. Unlike a sailing ship, you cannot manoeuvre a balloon. They tried this, they put oars on them, they put sails on them, but they lost sight of one great difference between the balloon and the sailing ship. Whereas the sailing ship can sail against the wind, the balloon cannot. The reason being, the sailing ship is suspended in two mediums. The hull is in the water, and the water resistance against the hull can be used to combat the air resistance against the sails and thus get a navigable vessel. With the balloon, the entire thing is suspended in the air, and therefore regardless of what type of sails you put on, the thing goes in the same direction. There is no water pressure to combat the wind pressure. So various people decided to try and make the balloon a navigable vessel. And this was done in a number of ways. As I say, they tried oars, but again, air is so much less dense than water that the oars were a pathetic attempt and had no effect whatever, except to make the crewmen rather tired. If anyone likes to try getting in a rowing boat and rowing it with the oar out of the water, they'll probably find it makes them a downside tired by putting the oar in the water. Except that the sudden stop at the end of the stroke is much greater. The first attempt with the navigable balloon, as it was known, were again with fairly small engines, and at this stage the internal combustion engine is unknown. They developed a propeller fairly early in the piece. They tried to work this in a number of ways. First, there was manpower pedalling on multiple cranks, which was not effective. With small steam engines, but again, a steam engine needs a boiler, which is of necessity a very heavy piece of equipment. And also, with a newfangled invention known as electricity. And in fact, perhaps the first successful airship was powered by electricity. But whilst the electric motor is quite light, the storage batteries which propel it is probably a greater weight load than the boiler and attendant firebox. It does have the one advantage, of course, is that it doesn't throw sparks out. The first successful airship was probably one built by a Brazilian in Paris, and his name was Santos Dumont, and he eventually won a prize for flying around the Eiffel Tower. Meanwhile, there was a gentleman in Germany called Count von Zeppelin, who was a retired army officer, who had been an observer in the American Civil War and had actually had one flight in an observation balloon in that war, and was rather impressed with the large panorama of battlefield which could be seen from the balloon basket. And being a cavalry officer and an officer in an army that had seen several wars, he immediately saw the military potential of aerial observation. But again, in the American Civil War, they were using the round balloon, and it was a most unstable platform, and of course it could only be raised behind the enemy or behind their own lines, and could not be navigated. And Zeppelin was very quick to realise that if you could fly this thing over the enemy lines, you could see a lot more. Also, you could make the enemy extend his ammunition trying to shoot at you, with very little effect. So Zeppelin came back and thought quite a lot about the idea, but didn't do anything until he read a letter by the German Postmaster General, and telecommunications get a rap here, who wrote a letter on aerial mail and airship travel. And he envisaged a peculiar type of train made up of balloons. There would be a train of balloons, loosely coupled, something like that. And these were supposed to be able to carry mails, and also it was hoped to carry freight. The small detail of how you were going to control a train in the air without any rails to guide it was never solved. But Zeppelin built a model of this thing, was not successful, and it was 1901 or 1902 before he built his first airship. Now, the earlier airships had been more or less elongated balloons, which were a rubberized fabric with a car and the engine strung on them by wires, with no framework whatever to hold the thing rigid. This had been improved upon by putting a metal or a wooden keel along the bottom, and the balloon was fastened to this keel and everything else was attached to the keel, which gave them some rigidity. But Zeppelin was quite unique in the fact that instead of having the gas in a bag which was dependent upon air pressure and the gas pressure inside to maintain its shape, he envisaged that the gas should be inside a rigid framework. And he chose aluminium, which was a reasonably new metal at the time, a very light metal, not a particularly strong metal, but extremely light. And he chose this to make his frame. Now, the first Zeppelin was not particularly successful. It made a number of flights and was eventually broken up. It was 1905 before he made another one. This made one flight and it crashed. and several others crashed. Now, Zeppelin had used his own resources for the first one and for the second one, and then ran out of money. But in the early 1900s, the science of flight was probably even more in the public imagination than flying to the moon was in the early 1960s. And he obtained permission from the King of Württemberg, which was one of the independent German states at that time, to raise a state lottery. And the people of Württemberg, and in fact the whole of Germany, responded quite readily to these lotteries and allowed Zeppelin to develop his airship. He was quite affectionately known as the Mad Count, and this was in the days when people wouldn't take an automobile trip of more than about 5 or 10 miles without preparing for disasters along the way. So he started off with his airships purely on public subscription. The military authorities in Germany at that time were still convinced that the cavalry was the means of scouting for the army, as in fact were the military authorities of all nations. And the aeroplane was considered to be a newfangled toy and of absolutely no military significance. However, he did eventually get the Kaiser interested and took the Crown Prince for a flight on one of the small commercial Zeppelins. They started carrying passengers on more or less joy flights. There was no regular service anywhere. And the military did reluctantly agree to use the Zeppelin on maneuvers, and it proved quite successful. Around about the same time in England, the Royal Flying Corps were using aeroplanes on army maneuvers and experiencing a certain amount of success. But as one famous English leader said, the only thing the aeroplane was any good for was to frighten the cavalry horses. And it was a damn nuisance. The result was you had England and France virtually developing aeroplanes, although France was developing airships. But Germany, because of the actions of Zeppelin, were concentrating on the airship. And although we possibly see now that the aeroplane had the greatest potential, in those days, I think we must concede that the Germans were adopting a far more practical approach, because the aeroplane in those days was a very temperamental and a very limited vehicle. And it wasn't until a good 12 months after the war started that the aeroplane really began to prove itself, even though it is credited with saving the British Army and the retreat from Mons. It was virtually not a particularly reliable weapon until well into 1916. Now, once the Germans saw the worth of this thing in the military field, the army became interested, and also the German navy. The army, because they wanted it for scouting, and they felt that by flying over the enemy lines, they realized then they could see much more than they could get with cavalry, which first of all had to penetrate the lines of the enemy and get behind them to make their observations, and even more importantly had to breach those lines again to get back. It's completely useless seeing what the enemy is doing if you can't report it. The Navy, on the other hand, felt that the Zeppelin would be a very fine scouting weapon and would probably replace or partially replace the light cruiser, which up until then was the scouting vehicle for the Navy. The result was both the Army and the Navy ordered Zeppelins. Also, I might mention, there were other manufacturers in Germany who were building airships besides Zeppelin. there was a firm called Parseval who were building a non-rigid airship, and in fact it was a particularly good airship, so much so that one was bought by the English, another two were ordered by the English, but war intervened before they could be delivered, and naturally the Germans hung on to them. We probably reciprocated by hanging on to a couple of battleships we were building for Turkey. But when war started, the German Zeppelin fleet was particularly small. The Navy had one airship in service and the Army had three. But they had one tremendous psychological advantage. Because of the way in which Zeppelin had pioneered the airship, and because of the way that he'd done it through public appeal and public enthusiasm, it had got tremendous press coverage, both in Germany and throughout the Western world. And naturally, journalists then, as they are now, are more interested in selling papers than in producing factual reports. And the Zeppelin was lauded considerably above its capabilities. And these reports were read in England and in France and in the other various countries. So when war was declared, the English were in some trepidation as to the effectiveness of the Zeppelin. And they were, in fact, anticipating that the Zeppelin could be used against them with rather telling effect. This was built up in as much as it was 1915 before the Germans used the Zeppelin against the English. While some people may say this was good psychology in building up the anticipation and the worry, it was technical, I'm afraid, rather than psychological. They just didn't have them, and the ones they had would not get to England. They had very limited range. At the time, their ceiling was not particularly high. Their engines were not reliable. Their method of construction was comparatively slow because the method of holding the gas, they had to find a gas-proof container, and this was made by using what was called gold beater skin. Now, gold beater skin is actually the intestines, or the wall of the intestines of oxen, something like sausage skin. It's called gold beater skin for the simple reason that when hammering gold, which is a very precious and a very delicate metal, the gold beaters used to put a layer of the skin over the top of the gold to prevent the hammer from indenting the metal underneath and to protect the metal from the hammer. This was how it got the name gold beater skin. Some people have had rather exotic ideas of what gold beater skin is, but it's purely the intestines of oxen. But as you can readily imagine, this material comes in very, very small pieces. And when you get an airship, which is something like 500 feet long and 48 feet diameter, containing 18 cells made of this material, you need an awful lot of it. It's still rather a mystery to me where they got so many oxen in Germany as to provide this material. Later in the war they went to process cotton and other materials, which in fact proved perhaps a little bit better. Not only did they have to get a lot of this gold beater skin, but they had to use at least two, and usually in the early days at any rate, three layers of it. It was very carefully put together and glued, and then placed in the bays of the airship. Now, your airship had girders, and across these girders They had wires thrown at various cross pieces, and this contained the cell within its particular phase. The rest of the cell was retained by the frame, which in turn was covered with linen. And later, when linen became scarce, with a cotton fabric. This cotton fabric was treated with a waterproofing dope and a pigmented dope to prevent the ultraviolet rays of the sun from rotting it. So the seamstresses of Germany were kept in quite busy in manufacturing their airships. The first raid on England was one on Norfolk, which took place on the 19th of January 1915. Two airships took part. They killed four people, they wounded 17 people. There were no aeroplanes went up against them, there were no guns fired in anger against them. Such was the state of the defence of England at that time. The interesting thing with the airships and why they held such terror for the English could perhaps be explained by the fact that it was such a long time before an airship was shot down over England. In fact, the first airship that was shot down over England was on the 2nd of September 1916. It's a long, long time between the 19th of January 15 and the 2nd of September 1916. A good 20 months. And when you're getting pounded by something, regardless of how small that pounding may be, for 20 months, and you're underneath it and you can't see any effective means to counter it, it becomes a very terrifying weapon. And this was perhaps the greatest use of the Zeppelins, was the terror they instilled in the population in that period. Not so much the terror of what they did, but the terror of what they were going to do. Much the same as the Stukas of the Second World War. They found they were a far more effective weapon when instead of dropping a bomb every time they dived, they fitted screamers to their wheels or their undercarriage, and they only dropped a bomb once in every few dives. This is particularly good psychology. It's perhaps medieval psychology and comes from the old torture rack, where they put you on the rack and they stretched you, which was quite painful. But the main pain was when they suddenly let the wheel go and you snap back again. Well, this business of the Stuka diving and not letting anything go meant that you tensed yourself up waiting for the bomb and it didn't come. The Zeppelins were much the same. As I say, the English people have read so much about them in the German press and in fact in their own press that they expected much more of them than they were capable of producing. I might mention the German Navy expected much more of them the same way. The German Navy also used their Stukas to some advantage in scouting for the fleet. But again, engines were unreliable, their range was limited, and the Zeppelins could not fly in bad weather. And navies are notorious for sailing in bad weather, particularly in wartime. It's the best cover they can have. So that the effects of the German scouting for the German fleet were very limited. Usually when the fleet wanted them, they were unavailable. They did perhaps save the German fleet a couple of times, particularly at Jutland. Some people consider that it was the scouting of the Zeppelins that saved them, and it possibly was to a certain extent, but through accident rather than design. The Zeppelin part of the English force, which they reported as being the English fleet, and caused the Germans to retire, and in so doing they were able to get back before the English fleet had engaged. But the paradox of the situation was that they had not seen the English fleet at all, they'd seen the Harwich force, which the German Navy could have eaten. However, had they done so, it's very doubtful if they would have got back and avoided Gallagher and the main British fleet. The Army also used their Zeppelins for reconnaissance, but the Army used far less imagination than the Navy, and again they were possibly at a greater disadvantage than the Navy, inasmuch as where the Navy seldom engaged the British Navy, the Germans were fortunate or unfortunately confusing both the British and the French Army, and they sent their Zeppelins over the lines in daytime. As I say, their sailing was limited, and quite a number of them were shot down, mainly by small arms fire. If you get enough rifles, shooting holes in a gas bag is going to leak. It may leak slowly, but the more holes, the faster the leak becomes. If it hasn't a great margin of just available, it will come down, and the German Army did in fact lose a lot of airships in this way. The Navy, on the other hand, lost most of their airships at sea, particularly in the early stages through the weather, engine failures, and the airships having to valve hydrogen above pressure height in conditions of electrical disturbance and causing the hydrogen to ignite. Now, I might explain pressure height as being with an airship. As you go higher, the gas in your gas bag expands until you reach a certain height that the gas cell will either burst or you must allow hydrogen to escape. So in the top of each of these bays, there was a valve. And when the pressure inside the cell became more than a certain amount, this valve automatically opened and allowed the gas to escape. Now, if you were flying through an electrical storm and the hydrogen escaped, it's a highly inflammable gas, and when mixed with oxygen, a highly explosive gas, and if a spark hit it, it was one very big bang, and they burnt very readily. Those of you that know where the Hindenburg or seen the picture of the Hindenburg, the destruction of the Hindenburg took all of 30 seconds. So they were quite a deadly weapon. They were very much a two-edged sword. The English and the French tried various means of combating them, particularly as the civilian populations of both London and Paris took a very dim view of having these things drop bombs on them. The first effective means the English adopted was to get some French 75mm cannon, which was a particularly fine weapon, and mount them on trucks, which used to go tearing around London when the alert was given, try and take up a strategic position to shoot at the Zeppelin. These guns were probably one of the greatest weapons the Germans had, really, because besides terrifying the motorists and causing very great panic with pedestrians, they also fired a shrapnel shell. And there's a very true saying that what goes up must come down. And in the early stages, I say a lot of people of London were not amused by Zeppelins, and they were quite terrified of the results. Human nature being what it is, everybody wanted to see one of these things. Everybody used to go out in the street to watch. We all have that feeling, it can't happen to me. Unfortunately, very few of them were killed by the Zeppelins, but quite a lot of them were killed by their own falling shrapnel from the 75-pounder guns and from the later guns that we had, until such time as they developed a really fragmentary anti-aircraft shell, which instead of flying into the large jagged chunks of shrapnel that the normal artillery shell produced, broke up into much smaller pieces which had lost most of their effect when they hit the ground. So that quite a lot of the casualties were caused by our own defences. They also used searchlights to try and illuminate the Zeppelin. And in many cases they managed to illuminate the Zeppelin quite well, but an ordinary artillery piece mounted on the back of a truck is not the most accurate weapon in the world. Again, it was probably the first war in which this type of artillery had been used, and the manufacture of shells is a highly complex and highly scientific business, and the quality of shells, both British and German, in the early days of the First World War left very much to be desired. So that most of the shells burst fairly harmlessly below the Zeppelin, or in front of the Zeppelin, or behind the Zeppelin, or beside the Zeppelin. And as I say, the only damage they did was to those below. The other method the British used, they made a balloon barrage, which consisted of a number of balloons, very much like in the Second World War. And you've got a line of balloons. From them is suspended a horizontal cable, and below that horizontal cable there are other cables stretched. Now originally this was to try and get the Zeppelins to fly above a certain height, to get them fairly close to the ceiling of the Zeppelin. This not only made it much harder for the Zeppelin to aim his bombs, but it also meant that you had a fair idea of at what height the aircraft was flying, and therefore you could set your anti-aircraft guns or shells to burst at that height, and thus save a certain amount of time in computing the height of the airship. They also employed listening devices along the coast to try and detect the sound of the Zeppelin's engines coming in and to be able to pinpoint the position of the Zeppelin. Now these listening devices were mounted on trucks again in many cases, and they had great horns poking out which picked up the sound, very much like the horns on the old-time gramophone, only much larger. And here the British made a rather startling discovery. They tried all sorts of people to man these things with very limited results, until they put a blind person on them. And they found that the blind could detect the direction of sound much better than a person with normal vision, mainly because by lacking in vision, the blind person had to develop his sense of hearing. And so a blind man was, you could say, a rather primitive form of radar tech. He could detect the direction of the sound much easier. And this is work sound detecting is based on a very simple principle. You've got a horn there. You've got another horn there, you've got the fellow sitting there, this horn going into this ear, this horn going into this ear, and the thing pivots. Now when you get virtually equal noise in both ears, then you're facing the object that's producing the sound. And this is exactly how they operate. So much for the early defence, which I might mention was under the Commander of the Royal Naval Air Service, the Lieutenant Commander Rawlinson. And it was, I think we should say, almost completely ineffective. The ground defence was eventually handed over to a Major General Ashmore of the Army, and it did become more effective, not because the Army was more efficient, but because at the time he took over, better and more sophisticated weapons and a greater number of weapons had become available. Now the Germans had a number of problems in operating their airships. the big problem they had, possibly their biggest problem, which they still had in the Second World War, is that the weather comes from England to Germany. In other words, the weather comes in from the Atlantic, or the prevailing weather comes in from the Atlantic, crosses England and then crosses the continent. And this meant the Germans had virtually no idea of what weather they were flying into. This probably contributed as much to the defeat of the Zeppelins as anything else. They also had to find England. In other words, they had to navigate. Now, whereas a ship can take readings of the stars, it's a little bit difficult in a Zeppelin because you've got a filthy great envelope on top of you. Also, you're flying much faster than a ship, and sextants were fairly primitive in those days. But radio was a pretty new innovation, and the Germans have always been perhaps quicker than we have in some ways to adopt new innovations to warfare. So they organised a system of radio beams in Germany, or radio receiving stations, unfortunately for them. They have a radio receiving station there, there and say there. Here's England out here. The Zeppelin's flying along here. Now unfortunately, because of the state of radio, these stations didn't send the beams out. The Zeppelin sent out a signal, and these stations took a bearing on the signal from the Zeppelin and gave it its bearing and position. Now radio, as I say, is a very fine thing, but unlike a telephone, there's very little privacy with radio. So you rely on privacy by means of using codes, which have been the game of military forces from time immemorial. It's a great game. One side develops a code and the other side cracks it. Then it all starts over again. Now the Germans had a code book early in the war which had been obtained by the British through devious means, much like the Kimlani money affair, but nevertheless they got it. And the Germans knew they had it, so everything was quite fair and above board. Both sides were quite happy. The English were quite happy in the fact that they cracked this German code. The Germans were quite happy in the fact that the English had cracked it, so they used another one. And everyone was blissfully happy. Except that the new code book the Germans had developed, whilst, as most of you being Navy know, are in very heavy lead-covered books, which, if your ship looks like being sunk or taken, it's hurled furiously over the side. Doesn't do much good in a Zeppelin when you're over enemy territory to chuck it over the side. It's going to land beautifully at somebody's feet. So the German Zeppelin crews were forbidden to carry this code book with them when they flew on missions over England. And here we get the dear old bureaucratic system coming into operation. To ensure they didn't do it, all airships leaving for England had to radio the base that they had left this code book behind. There was a small room in the old building of the Admiralty, room number 40, which Admiral Hall controlled, who was the intelligence officer for the Navy, and he had a very fine band of very elderly people who had possibly spent a misguided youth and possibly their old age in retirement working out cryptic crosswords in the Times. And these people were found ideal for breaking codes. They didn't have things like Enigma and Ultra in the First World War. I'm not too sure that they had them in the Second World War. But the point is, as soon as the English heard this call, the code book had been left behind, they knew there was a raid coming on England. so they can alert their defences and get ready for it. So I say in 1915 and 1916 it didn't do them much good. They didn't have any darn defences. They had a few aircraft, obsolete ones, but by the time the aircraft got up to the height the Zeppelins were operating at, the German crews were drinking their beer back in their base. Now, as well as the radio location, which you could say the Zeppelins pioneered for aircraft, they also pioneered another very valuable adjunct for flying, and this was aviation medicine. Because the average aircraft of the day could stay up for a maximum of 3 hours, it usually flew at about 10,000 feet, whereas the Zeppelin could stay up for 8 or 9 hours and flew at heights of something around 17,000, 18,000 feet. Now the Air Force today insists, as did the Fleet Air Arm, if you fly at a height greater than 10,000 feet, the pilot must use an oxygen mask and breathe oxygen rather than air. Because at heights above this height, there's a much smaller degree of oxygen in the air than normal, and you do tend to suffer from a complaint known as anoxia, or lack of oxygen, which has much the same effect on the human body as alcohol. It makes you lose your faculties without realizing you're losing them, and you exhibit much the same symptoms as you do when drunk. And this is not conducive to good military discipline or to navigating a vessel of war. So the other thing, of course, is that above 10,000 feet, your temperature is getting down to the minus scale on the Celsius thermometer, which is rather cool. And you've got extreme cold coupled with lack of oxygen. There were several German crews that went to sleep on the flights. You also had water-cooled engines that were operating these things. The water froze in the radiators. In many cases, the engine had to be closed down. While the engineer in the gondola put a blowpipe under the radiator and warmed his water up again. You also had to feed your crews. Normally they took a thermos of coffee and some sandwiches with them, and this didn't improve much during the whole of the war. But the protective clothing that was developed did improve to the extent that the Germans developed electrically heated flying suits. And they developed a crude oxygen breathing apparatus. Very sophisticated for those days, but very crude by Second War standards. But they did in fact pioneer very much of the aviation medicine that made the bombing raids of the Second World War possible. So I say the English, on the other hand, pioneered other things. They pioneered the use of the listening devices. They pioneered the balloon barrage, which was extremely effective in the Second War, more so than the first, because they had means of combating the aircraft when they kept them to height. But overall, it's a very difficult thing to say whether the Zeppelin was a success or a failure, and there will be as many arguments on this, I think, as who shut down von Richthofen. The Germans expended a lot of money on Zeppelins. They didn't do a great deal of damage. They killed quite a number of people, ran into hundreds, they wounded a few thousand, and they caused a staggering sum of damage of something like £1.5 million. And to do that, they had 51 raids on England, and they used 199 Zeppelins. They lost a lot of crews. They employed a lot of men on the ground to produce the Zeppelins and to maintain the Zeppelins and to operate the Zeppelins, who could probably be more use in the fighting forces or in producing aircraft. But to counterbalance that, the English spent a lot of money on ground defences, on guns, on searchlights, on balloon barrages and on aircraft, and they lost a lot of production because it became the usual thing when the Zeps came over, you shut the factory down and you all went down to the cellars. So it cost both sides a lot of money. It was probably a good thing really, because it kept both sides pretty busy with a comparatively small loss of life on both sides. Now, there were other airships operating beside the Zeppelin. As I said, the Germans had a passable airship, a non-rigid, which didn't see very much use. Another firm in Germany called Schütt-Lanz also produced an airship. And strangely enough, their airship, although it got very little publicity, was a more modern concept and a more efficient machine than the Zeppelin. Whereas the Zeppelin had a fairly elongated shape. The Zeppelin was shaped somehow like that, with a rounded nose, a fairly flat fuselage, a tapered tail. The Schütt-Lanz was more of the bullet-shaped or teardrop-shaped machine, which is a far more aerodynamically sound shape. The only difference was the Zeppelin was built of metal, the Schütt-Lanz was built of wood. And some of the early Schütt-Lanz actually pioneered the geodetic construction used in the Wellington bomber. The Zeppelin itself had circular frames, a couple of longitudinal stringers. The Schütt-Lanz had a spiral lattice system going round, and as I say, pioneered the geodetic development, which was used later in the Wellington bomber in the Second War. The British also, contrary to popular knowledge, operated more airships than the Germans. They started with more, they finished with more. The difference was the British airship was a small, non-rigid airship, and it was used purely for scouting and for anti-submarine patrols. It was not used for attack purposes at all, whereas the German Zeppelin was used as an attacking weapon rather than as a defensive weapon. Now, there were some interesting things with Zeppelins. The engines were slung underneath or outside the bag. The control tower was slung underneath the Zeppelin. And the crew of the Zeppelin contained quite a large variety of people, including sailmakers, to repair rents in the outer surface, but mainly to repair rents in the gas bags themselves, caused either through tears or through chafing on the wire frame or from bullet holes. The engineers were in the gondolas with their engines, but the old Zeppelin used to cruise along at about 60 miles an hour, and there were ladders going up from the control car and the engine gondola into the gas bag. And men used to climb up and down these ladders quite nonchalantly, 15, 18,000 feet above the surface, going along at 60 miles an hour. Inside the Zeppelin, there were vertical ladders going up between the gas bags. So it was up here, and down here on some of them, you had a platform on top with machine gun stations to defend the airship against marauding aircraft. It must have been a damn cold and a damn lonely spot. They had water-cooled Maxim machine guns with great quilted padding over them to stop the water from freezing, and there was always some leakage of hydrogen, which gives off a fairly sickly smell, and you'll have a 38 or a 48 foot climb right through this with flapping gas bags about that far away on either side. It was certainly no place for anyone suffering from claustrophobia. The Zeppelins had something between 3 and 6 engines, which drove a large 10 foot wooden propeller. The engines were developed quite considerably. In fact, if any of you saw the film Chitty Chitty Bang Bang from Walt Disney, which was a rather fanciful car, this story was, well, the original Chitty Chitty Bang Bang was in fact a wheel racing car which raced the Crooklands in England after the war, and it was powered by a massive great Maybach Zeppelin engine. I believe it was a complete monster of a thing to handle that eventually killed the driver. But these engines were getting up around the 360, 400 horsepower, great straight six cylinders, straight eight cylinders, and they had huge reduction gearing on them and reverse gears. And then you'd have an engine here underneath with three engines in it in the gondola. This engine drove a propeller here. This one's got a shaft drive and screw propellers up on the side of the envelope on an outrigger system. So you have your engine bay there with an outrigger propeller up there and there. All in all, the Zeppelin was a, for those days, a masterpiece of engineering. You had a machine approximately 48 foot diameter, 650 foot long, and weighing something like a mere 37 tons. For a naval architect that's dealing in battleships with 12, 16 inch armor plate, this is probably a very frightening concept to see this thing made of very fragile aluminium girders tied together with piano wire. And the thickness of the girders was measured in thousandths of an inch. I think I did mention that Zeppelins were used on one occasion in the Second World War. The last Zeppelin to be built was the Graf Zeppelin II, which was in fact finished after the Hindenburg burnt at Lakehurst in 1937. The Graf Zeppelin I was put back into mothballs at that time. The Graf Zeppelin II did one flight along the coast of England very early in the Second World War and caused quite a panic from those who saw it, and it was purely and simply to do a reconnaissance to try and determine what these funny looking towers were that the English had built along their coast, which were in fact the radar towers which played such a prominent part in the Battle of Britain. That was the last flight of the Graf Zeppelin II, and in fact the last flight of any rigid airship. Airships are still being used, very limited potential. The Americans used them extensively in the Second World War, but again they were non-rigid airships. The Americans still have one or two Goodyear airships in commission, which are used purely and simply for advertising purposes. They have great neon lights along the side, or incandescent lights, which light up, and one of them has a big American flag in it, or various other, by Sud soap powder or something. The Germans are also using a small non-rigid airship. They have about three of them operating for a similar purpose in Germany. The great enigma of airships today would be Russia, who we know are using them, but we think they're using a semi-rigid for cargo carrying around the Siberia area. And there is talk that there was considerable talk they were trying to build a big rigid. Now the Zeppelin, early in the war, started off with 400,000 cubic feet of hydrogen. It finished the war with just over 10 million cubic feet of hydrogen. The Hindenburg had 7 million cubic feet of hydrogen. The prospect for the rigid airship today has been considered by various bodies. The Americans have done some research on it. The Russians are known to have done a lot of research, but they're talking of airships now well over 1,000 feet long and with something like 15 million cubic feet of helium, not hydrogen, and possibly with atomic power plants, with the power plant inside the envelope itself. The airship is perhaps a brilliant concept for an atomic power plant, because you have the space in which to put the thing, to carry the shielding, which is necessary to prevent radiation escape, and also, which you don't have in an aeroplane, and also, if an airship happened to crash, you've got all this structure to absorb the shock, so that your nuclear power plant and its shielding would probably land intact and not be breached, which of course is a vital concept with any nuclear power unit. For long haul situations where you've got to go over water and land, of course the airship is ideal. It can carry a much larger load than the aeroplane and a much bulkier load than the aeroplane, and it can carry it more cheaply. It remains to be seen, of course, just how far they will go. Again, they've got aeroplanes now that will carry mighty big loads. They're mighty ugly aeroplanes, but they work. And possibly Russia would be about the only country in the world that's got the terrain that is suitable for the airship to operate commercially. As far as rigid airships were concerned, of which the Zeppelin was the example, there were only virtually three countries in the world that did much towards developing rigid airships: Germany first and foremost, England and America. Now the English built an airship before the First World War, which was about as successful as the first Zeppelin. It broke up coming out of its shed and never flew, and the English are notorious for their sense of humour. They had christened this thing the Mayfly. They had no intention of being humorous on that occasion, but it turned out a most appropriate name. Later on, they built other rigid airships, mainly copies of Zeppelins that they captured pieces of. They built two wooden airships, the R-31, the R-32. They have one claim to fame in their R-34, which was the first airship to fly across the Atlantic Ocean. It flew across the South Atlantic before the Graf Zeppelin, or flew across the Atlantic before the Graf Zeppelin. They had some most unfortunate experiences with airships, the R-38, which they started and stopped and then started again and were trying to sell to the Americans. Crashed on its final proving flight with considerable loss of life. They built two airships which got a lot of publicity after the First World War, the R-100 and the R-101, which was a peculiar setup in which, of course, England then had the empire in which the sun never set, and communications within that empire were a terrific problem. And there were a lot of people who expounded the airship theory. There were even more people who were against it. And they decided to build two airships, one by government contract and one by private enterprise. There was a Labour government in at the time. And they were sort of trying to determine which was the more economical concept. The R-100, the private airship, used the more or less traditional Zeppelin type construction and did fly to Canada and back. However, it did not achieve the payload proportion of the Zeppelin, so it would not have been an economical concept. Also, they did not manage to obtain the sufficient gas tightness in the cells, which meant it lost something like 1 million cubic feet of hydrogen on the return trip, which made it expensive. The R-101 was the government-built airship. It suffered from even more damaging things, in as much as they tried to pioneer the use of stainless steel. They tried to fit diesel engines to it, which were, in other words, they tried perhaps to do too many new things on the one machine at the one time. The R-101 suffered from the even worse handicap of all is it was a government thing. We had a Minister for State who was very anxious to visit India, and it was designed to go to India, and the whole thing was rushed at the finish. Lord Thompson decided he would go to India and he would go in the R101. The public service in those days was much the same as it is now. When a cabinet minister said do it, everybody jumped. And the aircraft set off for India before it had actually done its four trials, and it got as far as France and crashed with very, very few survivors. In fact, it possibly has the record even to this day of being the most distinguished casualty list of any air accident the world has seen. After that, the English didn't take on airship building again. The Americans, on the other hand, got one, or built one airship, the Shenandoah, which was a direct copy of a wartime Zeppelin. They were supposed to get two Operation Zeppelins, but the crews cut the ropes in their shed and dropped them on the floor without any hydrogen in them, which bent them considerably. So the Americans eventually convinced the rest of the Allies to allow the Germans to build them one airship, which was about 3 million cubic feet. This was built by the Germans and flown by the Germans to America and was there refilled with hydrogen, with helium, and called the Los Angeles, and was probably one of the most successful airships flying post-war. They then built, mainly with German design staff, two other airships, the Macon and the Akron, the Akron and the Macon at least, which were unique in the fact that they were aerial aircraft carriers. These two Zeppelins, or two American type Zeppelins, had hangars inside here, and they had a trapeze which could drop down. They had little aeroplanes that they could, once they put them in the aircraft, in the airship, they took their wheels off them because they were of no further use. And they had a great trapeze up above the top wing that hooked onto this thing in the airship. They were then flung up into the hangar. And they were supposedly for fleet scouting. The airship would do the main scouting with the small aircraft scouting ahead and beside the airship to cover a greater area. Whereas both these airships, I might mention, crashed. The first one with considerable loss of life, the second one with very little loss of life. In Shenandoah, the German Zeppelin, they got crashed, or at least the German Zeppelin they copied crashed. And the Los Angeles was originally broken up, as was the German Graf Zeppelin. One interesting point I didn't mention with the wartime ones was the cloud car. This was a very thrilling device, really. As I said before, you cannot see through clouds. So some very intrepid person in the German Naval Airship Service designed what they christened a cloud car. This cloud car was something like one of those little aeroplane things at Luna Park. It had a tail on it, and it had a place for a fellow to sit, and he had a telephone, and the table had a telephone cable in it, and that was lowered down by the airship. So the airship flew above the clouds, and this little cloud car flew down below, and he would telephone back to the commander to tell him when he was on target, or when to drop his bombs, or when there were hostile aircraft approaching. It was used on a couple of occasions, but it had its problems. You had to winch it up and down, and winches are not the most exciting sort of things in aircraft. They tend to jam. Also, cables are rather prone to snap if you have to stop them suddenly. And it's must have been a very, very lonely, cold spot in that little cloud car. One of the Zeppelins shot down over England. They found the cloud car some distance away from the Zeppelin, but they didn't find anybody near it. and they're inclined to think that it was possibly still within the Zeppelin when she fell and just fell out as the Zeppelin disintegrated. Because as you can readily imagine, with about 10 million cubic feet of gas, hydrogen, which is to say will burn in 30 seconds, and you've got a metal framework which is approximately 18 gauge metal, it doesn't stay together very long when it starts to burn. There's nothing to hold it there. So all in all, with the Zeppelins and their use in war, I think possibly both sides came off about equal. Their main use as far as their raids on England was concerned was to disrupt production, and even more so to disrupt the British Army and the Navy, in as much as they were compelled by public opinion to bring troops, guns and aircraft back from France, where they were sorely needed to defend London, which was a pretty hopeless task. You cannot stop an aircraft getting over its target. You may stop several, but one will always get through. On the other hand, they tied up an awful lot of Germany's industrial potential and quite a lot of Germany's military and naval potential in manning them and operating them. They were, you could say, a complete dead end development as far as military usage was concerned. They were never a successful thing for scouting for the fleet. Oddly enough, the successful airship or fleet scouting was the type used by the English, but they never realised it fully. In other words, the blimp or the non-rigid airship. This was used extensively in the Second World War for escorting convoys from America. They can be moored on the ships. The ships could have a little mooring mast for them on the back, and they could come down, they could refuel, and they could go along with the convoy. And it is on record that no ship in a convoy escorted by non-rigid airships was ever sunk, which is a pretty commendable record. The reason being, of course, that if you look over the side of a ship, all you see is a very greasy green surface of the sea. If you get up a couple of thousand feet, you can see a submarine a long way under the water. The sea becomes very clear when you're a long way above it. And this is why they were particularly effective. Also, of course, in the Second World War, I said you could put an atomic engine in there. You can also put a fairly big radome in there. And in the Second World War, they were filled with helium, which did not explode like hydrogen. The main, as I said, the first one to be shot down over England was on the 2nd of September 1916, shot down by Leif Robinson. There were several shot down before that, mainly by artillery fire and small arms fire from the ground, flying low over the trenches. There was one shot down in France sometime before that, returning from a raid on England, by Sub-Lieutenant Warnford of the Royal Naval Air Service, who dropped a bomb on the thing. But he got it when it was coming back to its base and got down fairly low. And the crew were no doubt very tired. They'd been in the air a long time. They were probably suffering from anoxia. They shook him off the first time. They fought him off with gunfire, and I think they thought he'd gone home to bed, because he was a rather stubborn fellow. And he climbed up above it and dropped a little bomb on him. There was one survivor from that Zeppelin, and it was rather interesting. He fell out of it, and he fell through the roof of a convent and landed in a nun's bed. I understand he behaved as a perfect gentleman, but the bed broke his fall. But the thing that defeated the Zeppelin was the incendiary ammunition developed by the British. There were three types, the Brock, the Pomeroy and the Buckingham. They were particularly filthy types of weapon. In fact, any aircraft shot down with them under the laws of warfare at the time, would have entitled a pilot to be shot on the spot. They were actually an illegal weapon, and rightly so, if used against infantry. The British did use them against observation balloons, and in fact the Germans used a similar one. Like all wars, if one side gets a weapon, it's not long before the other side counters it if it's any good, or copies it, or develops it further. And these were an incendiary type bullet. They found with bullets going through the ordinary prayer people that would come in there, go through a sheet of cotton, a sheet of gold leader skin, another sheet of gold leader skin, a sheet of cotton, and keep going. Now whilst the bullet is probably red hot when it goes through, and hydrogen is a very inflammable gas, it will not catch fire unless it's in the presence of oxygen. And the bullet goes through so fast that both the bullet and the heat have gone before the oxygen can mix with the hydrogen. So all you get is a couple of little holes. This hole here doesn't mean a damn thing, it's on the bottom anyway, so the hydrogen's not going to come out there. And the amount that comes out the top through a hole made by a 303 bullet in a bag containing several thousand cubic feet of gas is pretty negligible. But the incendiary bullets were designed to virtually explode on contact with the fabric. So much so that the fabric here would explode the bullet, but by the time it exploded it was somewhere in there. Or possibly just in there and would blow a big hole in and with the gas come through. So I say they were a filthy type of weapon in as much as they were probably hated and probably as dangerous to the people using them as the people against whom they were used. They were a bit like a shotgun with a badly fitting breech. They were extremely sensitive. They would blow up in the gun itself. They would blow up in the ammunition pans on the Lewis guns. And it took quite a lot of effort, quite a lot of courage on the pilots of the aircraft to use them to actually carry them, particularly in the early stages. But they did have the effect of knocking the Zeps out of the war. Leif Robinson got a VC for the one he shot down. Sub-Lieutenant Warnford got a VC for the one he shot down. There was a certain amount of courage involved in shooting them down, possibly. They may not have murdered a VC in comparison with other deeds, but all declarations of warfare are governed to a certain extent by public opinion. And as Leif Robinson shot down the first Zeppelin after about 18 months of pounding the city of London, the public would not have accepted anything less. Both gentlemen were killed later. Warnford died within about a week of getting his Zeppelin. He crashed on testing and was killed. Leif Robinson was a very unfortunate fellow, really, because, as I say, he shot down the first Zeppelin after about 18 to 20 months of continuous bombardment. The result was he was made an absolute hero and fated. He was immediately made a flight commander, and when the Bristol fighter came out, he was made a flight commander and sent to France, which was unfortunate because he had no experience of France and fighting in France. And when he led his patrol across the line for the first time in a comparatively untried aeroplane, which was a very good one, but one which they didn't know how to use at that stage, he was unfortunate enough to be jumped on by the best of the German Air Service, and they lost nearly all of their flight, including himself. He was made a prisoner of war, and he died of flu just after his release at the end of the war. Well, I think that just about covers the Zeps. It hasn't been a lot of detail, but I think too much detail would probably be confusing until you've got an overall picture of it.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you're looking for more information about Australian naval history, then you should use our website. You'll find more podcasts, articles from our quarterly in-house magazine, Naval Historical Review, and a range of e-books, monographs, and ship's plans for sale in our online shop. If you have any questions or research inquiries about Australian naval history, then feel free to contact us. Use the link on the website homepage. The Society is a not-for-profit organisation which relies on your continuing support. Please use our website links to become a member, or donate now, or sign up as a volunteer, or subscribe to our newsletters. See you next time.